On this episode of Newt's World, we're going to talk with one of the smartest people to work for President Trump, somebody I've known since he was working in the U.S. Senate on budget issues. My guest today is Stephen Miller, former senior advisor to President Trump, and he's here to talk about his time serving in the White House and as a very, very thoughtful person who's been engaged in policy for years. He's also going to talk about how he thinks President Biden's liberal policies threaten the entire future of the United States. So, Stephen, it's great to have you with us, and I can't tell you how much I have cherished the many years that we've worked together all the way back to your time in the Senate. But I'm curious, if we could start with your background. I mean, you grew up in a liberal household, didn't you?
Yes. Well, first, I want to thank you for that very kind introduction. And at the risk of getting too saccharine, I want to say what a tremendous privilege and pleasure it's been to get to know you and work with you and glean so much wisdom from your insights and your experience over these many years, as you alluded to back when I was a staffer on Capitol Hill, and how helpful you were. And of course, you had no way of knowing then at the time that I was going to end up in the White House. And so I think it is important for people to know that Newt does that kind of thing all the time, where he will reach out to people who are working in staff jobs on Capitol Hill. In my case at the time, it was the Budget Committee, as you mentioned, to help them figure out how to articulate their ideas better, how to get buy-in and support for projects, how to mobilize the public behind important reform. And you've been helpful to me now throughout my whole career. So I really want to thank you for that.
I do want to say, Stephen, I will always remember getting on the campaign plane and you sitting about four or five seats behind Trump, banging away on your laptop. For a very long time, you were the speechwriter. And you had to pull all of these different policies, all these different ideas, and you were just right there calmly, methodically working away. It was amazing to imagine you going from the Senate Budget Committee to becoming sort of chief articulator of a national campaign. And then, of course, you went from there into the White House. But let me go back to the beginning. When you grew up in a liberal household, what changed you? Why did you become conservative?
Like so many people of my background, being Jewish in my case, I grew up in a very traditional liberal Democrat household. And they weren't leftist, just traditional liberal Democrats, people whose family very proudly voted for FDR, and it was considered a hero in my house, and rightly so, but that informed a liberal tradition. And people who voted for Democrat presidential candidates ever since then, as a matter of course. And this went back into several generations in my family. And I didn't really know any other way of thinking. I wasn't indoctrinated by any means. It was the air that I breathed. It was the environment around me. Everyone I knew, everyone I interacted with was a liberal Democrat or didn't have any thoughts at all on politics. But if they were asked, would just as soon say, yeah, I'm a Democrat. Around the time I was in middle school, I started to read literature from conservatives, and it just connected intellectually. Hard to explain why, it'd be hard to pinpoint exactly why, but I remember distinctly, as an example, in sixth grade, we had a class project, and they handed out the platforms of all the different political parties, and they said, basically, write a fake speech pretending that you're running for president under one of these different platforms. That might have been the first time in my life, now that I think about it, that I ever actually saw the Republican platform written out. And I remember thinking to myself, this all just makes sense. Like, well, of course we want to cut taxes. Who would ever want to pay more taxes? It seemed crazy to want to pay more taxes. We want to have safe and secure communities. Who wouldn't want that? You know, of course we want to have a strong military. I just remember reading it thinking, oh, this just makes a lot of sense. I didn't realize at the time that in the liberal enclave of Santa Monica, which is basically the most liberal suburb of Los Angeles, that reading the Republican platform and thinking this made a lot of sense was a heterodox thought. And then I started reading more conservative literature. One of the columns that actually really spoke to me was Charlton Heston. He used to write a weekly column mostly about the Second Amendment. It was carried in various NRA magazines, but it also touched on other issues of the day. And I remember just absolutely devouring that. And he was always has been for a long time an idol of mine, both as a political figure and, of course, also as a star in the golden age of film. Then that led me to start reading some books, and mostly they were political texts. You know, I read a lot of books from, for example, Rush Limbaugh. That was very informative. I read books from Sean Hannity. I read books from Larry Elder, who was very, very influential on my early thinking. And then I listened to a lot of talk radio. And I think for a lot of kids in Los Angeles, talk radio also is a very important part of opening your eyes and your ears to new ways of thinking. So by the time I was about 16 years old, I was pretty thoroughly Republican in my thinking and pretty thoroughly conservative in my thinking. And that's the year, my junior year of high school, when the whole world changed. And after the terrorist attacks, my school and the environment around me took the reflexive approach of blame America first. And I'm not saying everybody did, but a lot of people did. And that really, really offended me on a deep and personal level. And that's when I decided to get more politically active. And that's when I started writing. That's when I started organizing. And that carried me on, you know, through college. And a lot of my passion as a young American was in fighting back against left-wing indoctrination in school. And this was, by the way, this was like 10, 15 years before a lot of the stuff became so thoroughly commonplace that you now, you know, read about these things, you know, on your nightly news if you watch Fox. But at the time, you know, this was sort of at the cutting edge of a lot of this indoctrination, where every single event in U.S. history was taught from the perspective that America was wrong and always wrong, and uniquely evil, uniquely pernicious, never, ever morally right, never, ever justified in any decision that we ever made. So a lot of my early focus was in trying to learn the real version of American history, trying to teach and promote real patriotic values, and really focusing on the idea that the left's ideology was going to splinter America apart if it wasn't confronted.
So I'm curious, given that you're in Santa Monica, as you begin to come up with these obviously deviant ideas, what's the reaction both from your classmates and your teachers?
Most of my classmates were, I would say, more curious than anything else because they'd never been exposed to any of these ideas either. Of course, a handful of them were hostile, but it would be inaccurate to say that I was encountered by an overwhelming wave of hostility from my peers. I would say most of my peers were genuinely curious about these never heard before conservative ideas because they had grown up in such a liberal enclave. My teachers, on the other hand, some of them were quite aggressive and even punitive in terms of grading papers down or trying to unsuccessfully disparage me in front of class and things of that nature. And that never got under my skin, though. It never bothered me. I always had a very thick skin. But the teachers were much worse than the students. Most students, by and large, were open to hearing new ideas. The tragedy was that they weren't hearing those ideas from their teachers, which they should have been. And I remember, even at that age, 16, 17, thinking to myself that the extraordinary damage that's being done to young minds by teaching them that they were born in an evil country. Because if you start from that premise, then that means that our country's history isn't worth preserving, our country's values aren't worth preserving, our country's whole system of government isn't worth preserving, because why would it be if it's all born from evil? And I remember thinking that it takes away the joy out of life. It's not just a political thing, it's a quality of life thing. Who wants to go around with their head down, their shoulders slumped, their whole life lamenting the fact that they live in this evil, oppressive, warped, twisted society, all of which is a lie? But it struck me then, and it strikes me now, frankly, abusive to teach children these things.
So you survived high school. Where did you go to college?
I went to Duke University.
It's a long way from the California coast.
Yeah, I have a funny story about that, maybe not that funny, but it'll appeal to people who are making a decision about where they want to go to college. So I'd always been very politically active, but I also wanted a conventional college experience. And so the two schools I was deciding between were Georgetown, great school in many respects, and Duke University. So I went on a tour of each school, and each time they have student guides. And at Georgetown, they had a student guide dressed very sharply in a suit and tie and sitting us down in the classroom. And we asked about what the extracurriculars were, what he did after school, what he did on the weekends. He said, well, he interned here and he interned there, and he had this job and he had that job, and he was always very busy and working all the time and so on and so forth. And then I went on the same tour, Duke University. Our guide was wearing khaki shorts, flip-flops, a beat-up polo shirt, and I asked the same question. I said, well, what do you do when you're not in class, weekends, after school, etc.? His answer was, mostly Frisbee. Even despite that, I said that I'd like to go to Duke University because I want to have a real, honest-to-goodness college experience. You know, live in a real college town, a totally new place, totally new people. I knew I was going to be in Washington, D.C. sooner or later, so I wasn't in any rush to get there. But I wanted to have that idyllic, picturesque college experience. You're not going to find anywhere in the country that fits that image, that description more than Duke University.
So did you go to the basketball games?
I did, but I didn't like waiting in line, and that's the thing that's never changed. I wasn't thrilled about the idea of sleeping in a tent in the mud for weeks on end. So I did not go to as many games as others, given the fact that I didn't quite have that degree of patience and devotion. I watched much more of them on TV.
That's wild. I didn't realize that the student body had to queue up, you know, sort of first come, first served.
Yeah, because Cameron Stadium is a very old, very small stadium. It's a small stadium compared to others. And so it's not the case where if you just go to school that you can just get a good seat and that's that. To get good tickets, especially to big games, you got to wait in line for a long time. And if you really want good seats, then again, you're living in a tent for a while. And I remember freshman year, my roommate was doing the tent rotation. And, you know, it'd be like at midnight. And he'd be saying, where are you off to? And it's like, you know, 12 degrees outside. It's like, oh, that's my shift in the tent. I really never really regretted not doing the tent thing.
Did you come out as a basketball fan? I mean, do you watch basketball on TV?
You know, I came into and out of Duke University with baseball being the team sport that I watched the most, and then golf being probably my favorite sport to watch.
So when you get out of Duke, do you go to Washington?
Yes, my life plan was always that I was going to graduate from college and then go to law school. And I got very politically active when I was at Duke University, organizing events constantly, writing a column for the student newspaper. As an aside, I never imagined that 10, 11 years after I wrote those columns, that liberal journalists would be pouring over my college columns with such breathless interest. But I was very politically engaged, and in the sort of the formative political experience of my time at Duke, was the Duke lacrosse scandal. And I'm proud of the fact that I was one of the first people, not just local journalists, just one of the first journalists, period, who raised serious questions of fact and law about the persecution that was taking place. You know, we saw firsthand just how dangerous it can be to justice when you have a rogue prosecutor. And during that whole rush to judgment, I was sounding the note of caution and skepticism and saying that the evidence doesn't match up here. Everyone needs to take a breath and slow down. And a lot of incoming came my way taking that stance. And of course, and I was especially tough on our professors who shamefully and disgracefully rushed to judgment and declared the players in effect and then some, with their words, guilty without any evidence and without any trial, and without listening to the facts, because it fit their political worldview. And because of my experience in Santa Monica and Los Angeles, and I think the reason why I was sort of onto what was happening with the Duke case as quickly as I was, is because I knew from my youth how politics could so thoroughly warp justice. I think a lot of Americans might think to themselves, there's no way that many people could condemn somebody as guilty if they aren't guilty. But I knew that they could because I knew that for the left, justice doesn't mean what it means to me and you. To me and you, justice means the objective pursuit of truth. But to the left, justice means a political goal. And so after that experience, I decided I wanted to go to Washington, D.C., called my parents. I told them that I was not going to take the LSAT. This would have been my senior year in the fall. I'm not going to take the LSAT. I'm going to keep focusing on politics. I'll go to Washington, D.C. when I graduate. And if I decide I don't like it or that it's not working out, I can easily go to law school. But if I like it, I enjoy it. If I feel I'm making a positive difference in the world, then I'll just keep going. And obviously, I kept going.
Yeah, I was going to mention on the Duke lacrosse thing, the challenge on the left is they were symbolically guilty even if they weren't, because they should have been guilty. And it also relates, frankly, to what we're living through right now. It's an extraordinary reordering of reality based on emotion and a value set that doesn't care about facts. I've always thought that the Duke lacrosse team incident was one of the really key moments of understanding how sick the system was. So you go to Washington. Young people listening to this might be fascinated. You just bounce around, or how do you find a job?
I'm actually really glad to answer that question, because I do think I can give people some good advice, because I got a lot of good advice. So after I graduated in May of 2007, I took a little bit of time off, as one does after graduating from college, and I decided that I was going to start searching for a job in earnest in D.C. And I got some really good advice really early on that may seem self-evident, but a lot of people may not appreciate this. The first piece of advice I got from a good friend of mine was, you're not going to be able to get a job in Washington, D.C. as a young staffer remotely. You have to get to Washington, D.C. You're going to have to meet people and network physically present. So for young people out there, unless you have a connection with your local congressman or your senator, you're just starting from scratch like I was, and you don't know anybody in Congress and you want to get a job, you're not going to be able to do it in most cases by just sending your resume via email. Capitol Hill especially is very relationship dependent. You've got all kinds in Capitol Hill, but the one through line is successful people on Capitol Hill are able to build relationships. And so I was able to come up to Washington, D.C., stay somewhere relatively inexpensive in the scheme of things for a period of days. And the other piece of advice I got was, every time you have a meeting on Capitol Hill and you're looking for a job, ask that person for people you should talk with. So I got a couple intros to staffers. It didn't even matter who they were. A legislative director for one person, we call them LDs, a communications director for someone else, a legislative assistant for someone else. I got a few intros. And that was mostly just through a gentleman named Paul Teller, who came to give a small talk when I was at Duke. He was the executive director of the Republican Study Committee. He came to give a small talk. I got his business card. After I graduated, I sent him an email. He gave me a couple of introductions. And so what I did is every time I had a meeting, I said, can I please have the name of two other people that I should meet with? And then I would leave and I'd send that person an email and I'd say, you know, John Smith, I just met with him and he told me to go meet with you. After doing this for a day or two, you end up with basically a full schedule. And that gets to the point about you should treat searching for a job like having a job. So I wake up every morning, put on my suit, go to Capitol Hill, and 9 o'clock meeting here, 10 o'clock coffee here, 11 o'clock meeting there. And many people don't have any jobs to offer. You're just forming the relationship. Just pound on the pavement. And you do that for enough times, and eventually you get a lead. And sure enough, I don't even remember who anymore. If I sat down long enough, I could figure it out. But somebody gave me the lead that Michelle Bachmann, congresswoman from Minnesota, had an opening for a press secretary slot and that I should interview for it. And I got the interview, and it went very quickly. I met with her chief of staff. Then he referred me to the congresswoman. We hit it off immediately. And I think she offered me the job pretty much that day. And that was 6 weeks at that point in time.
So you went from Duke to your entry-level job being a press secretary?
Yeah. My first real job, you know, I had obviously did a lot of things, you know, in high school and college, but my first real job as a post-college adult was being a press secretary.
That's wild. That's a real tribute to your ability to sell. So you go from there, though, but when I first met you, you were already over in the Senate working on the Budget Committee.
Right. And so, you know, I kept networking my whole time on Capitol Hill so that when jobs opened, and that's how it works, it's word of mouth. So for those listening who are young, you're not going to find a job on Capitol Hill unless you've got very good connections just by checking job postings. It's word of mouth. People fill jobs with people they know or people that somebody else that they know knows. And eventually, I found my way onto the Judiciary Committee, the time Jeff Sessions was the ranking member, and then onto the Budget Committee. Again, Jeff Sessions was the ranking member there as well. And I got the slot as communications director of the Budget Committee. And that may seem to some like a dry job, but that would be a very significant error to think so, because we at the time were fighting on the fundamental issues about what kind of government we want to have in this country. Do we want a government that's accountable? Do we want a budget that's accountable? Do we want to know where our dollars go? Do we want to have transparency in government accounting? Do we want a welfare system that pushes people down? Or do we want to have an employment system that gives people a paycheck? Newt was always the one who had that line that just cuts to the heart of the issue, right? Which is that we want people to get paychecks, not food stamps. That was the hot issue at the time. As you might remember, Newt, Obama was president. And the big issue at the time was this big debate over, do we want to give people more welfare? Or do we want to give people more work? And that was really, I think, a lot of what you and I were talking about at the time.
That's right. And I should point out, by the way, that Sessions, who later on stumbled into unfortunate problems trying to serve as Attorney General, but at the time as a senator, he was very conservative, very courageous. I remember Calista and I went to a meeting, which was Trump's first meeting in Washington as a candidate, and it was all put together by Jeff Sessions. He was a very important force in 2015 and 2016. So you had a pretty good mentor in basic conservative philosophy and also in courage. I thought Jeff in that period was very, very gutsy and very prepared to stand up to his colleagues if he had to.
The Senate at the time, you know, it's changed somewhat now, not all the way, of course, but there is a real paucity at the time of senators who are willing to break from the party line on core issues. You had a lot of senators, good people all, who'd been there for many decades, which in and of itself is not a problem. I mean, you've got some senators who've been there for many decades who are absolutely fabulous, but and had just gotten caught in sort of a rote way of thinking and a rote way of doing business. And now we have a lot of exciting new faces in the United States Senate who are encouraging people to change the way we think about things and change the way we talk about things. But at the time, a lot of the work that we were doing was very innovative and was definitely defying the status quo thinking in the Senate.
How do you then make the jump from working in the Senate to working for Trump?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I actually went back at some point in time and looked at some old emails, or maybe somebody else found some old emails. But when the president was giving a CPAC speech, long before he ever declared he was running for president, I sent an email to a friend of mine saying that Trump needs to run for president. This was long before he declared for the White House. And I've been following his career for many, many years before that, like many other Americans had. And when he declared his candidacy, I knew then that I wanted to work for him. I knew then that he could win. And I felt very confident of both of those things.
Why were you so confident he could win?
Because part of what I've been working on for these last few years prior to this point in time, really working on intently, and even writing, you know, papers about it, circulated to other staffers and whatnot, in 13 and 14 and 15, was the idea that the Republican Party wasn't speaking to the working class, that we've been typecast as the party of big business, the irony of which becomes more apparent every day, Newt, because virtually all of Democrat money comes from big, powerful institutions. And all of these big, powerful institutions are the ones that are not only supporting Democrats, but blacklisting conservative voices. But at the time, the Republicans had allowed themselves to get typecast as the party of big business. And if we're being honest and engaging in some self-examination, they weren't doing enough themselves to push and advance policies to show that separation and to demonstrate that they were on the side of working people. A great example of this being China, right? Obviously a big feature of the president's campaign, but Republicans had failed to take a clear stance on China's cheating, its abuse of the economic system, its plundering of American IP. It could come across at times as a party of being too concerned about the investor class, if you will, who can make money regardless of where a factory is sited, right? In other words, if you have a factory producing AC units, it doesn't matter for the investor if that factory is in China because their capital can move. But American labor, of course, they're not going to move to China. So that factory moves, they're out of work. That's just one issue. I could cite many others. But I've been preoccupied with this idea that the Republican Party was failing to speak to and capture working class voters. And, you know, the evidence of that was Mitt Romney. The bottom fell out in 2012 with Republican support for Americans earning under 50K. It was a train wreck under 30K, and it was a pretty thorough shellacking under 50K. And it was clear after Romney's debacle and the loss of the working class voters that some urgent steps needed to be taken to win back those voters. And when candidate Trump came in proposing a slew of policies that had deep intellectual and intrinsic appeal to blue-collar voters, whether you're talking about making NATO pay its fair share, which is a classic example of Washington not getting it, but blue-collar workers caring deeply about whether or not their taxpayer dollars are going to fund troop deployments in Germany that Germany isn't paying for themselves, that's a huge issue that the establishment class never understood that President Trump was focused on. And burden sharing in our alliances in general. Whether the president was talking about how to unwind these costly conflicts in the Middle East, again, disproportionately borne on the backs of working class families, obviously the huge issue of the border and trade, I knew then that he had a formula that was going to win the primary and most likely was going to win the general election. And so I reached out to the campaign, frankly, within days of his announcing.
So when you reached out to the campaign, did you volunteer full time or what happened?
I got in touch through a mutual acquaintance with Corey Lewandowski. And at the time, you know, still working in the Senate. And so I volunteered to help out on the side. So I wrote a couple of policy papers. I edited other policy documents. In my spare time, I pitched stories to reporters. And I also helped advise about, here are some potential supporters that you could find. Here are some news outlets that you should be working with to help get more support on this or that item. And just offering my contacts and my expertise, such as it was, and again, doing some policy work. And then around Christmas time is when I said, I want to go ahead and do this full time. I called Corey and asked for a formal paying full-time position, which meant coming up to New York City. That's when I got the title of senior policy advisor for the Trump campaign. And then as you pointed out, that role eventually evolved to include speech writing as well.
What was it like to just be on the plane writing like crazy between each stop?
Well, it was exhilarating. I had a very unique setup because I think it was the first time in campaign history in 2016 that the policy shop and the speechwriting shop were merged, which provided radical efficiency of action. So fast forward through time, you get to the general election. So Hillary Clinton could give a speech that we could be watching on TV, and we could write a new policy and a new speech on the airplane, working with the president, and have it ready to deliver before we landed at the next stop. They provided an extraordinary degree of tactical agility to be able to develop new policy and new rhetoric on the fly, literally on the fly, in this case, you know, on an airplane. And I've always been a very calm, I'd like to think, level-headed person. But this experience required me, and I think captured it well, you just have to sort of find your inner zen. Sure, you're landing in 30 minutes, But you know what? You'll finish typing in 23 and a half minutes, and I'll give you just enough time to hit send and print. And so just very coolly, calmly, just typing away, getting it done. For those of your listeners who are golf fans, writing a speech under intense time pressure is like hitting a good golf shot. If you grip too tightly, you're going to shank it.
You were somehow relaxed in the middle of chaos?
In fact, I found that to be sort of my hallmark, if you will. And it's a skill that served me well in doing high-profile foreign policy addresses when we were traveling overseas because, you know, it could be 4 o'clock in the morning. There's some, like, big foreign policy development. You have to make some huge change to a speech, but you still have to have time to get it to the translators so it can get into the earpieces of all the foreign dignitaries listening in half a dozen different languages. And does anybody know if the National Security Advisor has read it or not? If so, do we have to wake him up? And what's he going to think of this section? And then we have to make sure that we, of course, have time to go over it again with the president and get his edit. If you're anything other than just extraordinarily calm, you're going to make mistakes. You just have to have this very just peaceful attitude about the whole thing, and that will bring out your best writing.
Well, and at least as I've observed, if you're working for Trump, he could easily be changing things almost up to the moment of delivery.
Almost always, in fact, up to the moment of delivery. You know, I know we're jumping through time here, but the first time that I flew on the president's plane with him, he immediately just put me at ease. He has this way of managing people where, and I'd met him before, but I mean, the first time as his employee, I was on the plane with him, and he has this way of just giving you that subtle reassurance, telling you that he has confidence in you, that he knows you're going to do a good job, that has this way of just, again, bringing out your very best work product. I can honestly say, having worked for a lot of people, that you're never going to meet anybody that, as a boss, makes you feel more appreciated when you give it your best. And always so complimentary, so kind. If you wrote something good and he was reviewing it and reading it, even if he had some changes that he wanted to make, some things are a little bit different, he would go out of his way to pause always and say, wow, it's a really great job. You really nailed it. And he meant it. And again, you know this, Newt, because you've worked around a lot of politicians your whole life. There's a lot of politicians who are less than voluminous in their praise and appreciation for their staff.
Doesn't it strike you that you're describing a remarkably different Trump than the news media image?
Yes. The disparity between how he's portrayed and the person that he is, affable, warm. You know, he didn't lose his temper with me in the entire time that I've known him. Now, again, here's how that matters, Nick, because you and I come from this world. You obviously operated at the highest level in politics, which is to be the Speaker of the House. But we both have been in politics, so you and I understand that politicians losing their temper with their staff is about as common as the sun rising in the morning. In the whole time that I worked for him, in all these intense moments, all these high-pressure situations, all of these high-stakes events, never had an incident where he lost his temper with me. By the way, I wouldn't have cared if he did. He'd have every right to. He's the president of the United States. He needs the best out of his people. He needs to motivate however he can. I'm not saying that because it'd be a problem if he did. Everyone's entitled to lose their temper from time to time. My point is just to say that as a boss, he was so easy to work with. I mean, the highest levels of power. And yet, he would call me before a big event, 6 o'clock in the morning, and just say, like, hey, Steve, so we got the big speech at the UN today. Like, you know, yes, sir. Hey, here's some ideas I have. Type these out. Send them over to me. Do the best you can. And type them out. Send it back to him. He'd say, hey, all right, open up your computer. Line 3, change this. Okay, next thing, change this. All right, over here, change this. Scratch that paragraph. Give this a try. Like, that was the nature of it. It was a thrill to work with him. And as you mentioned, Newt, he's editing things constantly, constantly, constantly up to the last second, and also doing very long form dictations. You know, he'll dictate 2 or 3 pages in a row, unbroken, but always so calm about it, always so reassuring, which is unusual in this line of work, right? To be doing that kind of work at that level as I did for 5 straight years, I mean, that tells you, because a lot of times people would get, quote unquote, burned out. I never was even close to getting burned out because he made it such a joy.
But yeah, one of the things I was intrigued by is that you could give Trump a speech he had approved. It could be on the teleprompter, but particularly at the rallies, he would then segue off and come back, and you had to somehow figure out on the teleprompter where he was coming back to, because he would riff and try to make it sufficiently unpredictable that the audience was engaged with him. Did you find that tricky to try to figure out the teleprompter interface with a guy who was willing to go off on various riffs during a speech?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know this, but he had a teleprompter operator that he developed a strong working partnership with. And so the two of them really sort of understood each other's rhythms, for lack of a better term. But that sort of became intrinsic to the process, right? And so I think a good way to think about it is this. People come to a rally speech expecting to hear authentic, real-time President Trump interacting with the audience, you know, feeding off of their energy and following their cues. So if, you know, if they're really interested in the topic, right, he'll take note of it. Instead of moving on, he'll keep digging into that topic. What that means from a writing standpoint is that you need to, and again, this is all done collaboratively. The rally speeches kind of develop like the English Constitution, right? They're based on the long body of unspoken common law. By that I mean, it just gradually evolves. Sort of, so here's what's worked last time, keep that. Here's what we'd like to change that. And then you just keep building off that template. And it's entirely done based upon just getting constant feedback and constant input from the president, so that it exists as a kind of living text. And so again, from a writing standpoint, that's what it means, is you create this living text that sort of breathes, that allows you to move in and out, versus say like a formal speech, like just to take a random one, like the speech to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, one of my favorite speeches that President Trump did over the last 5 years. And I think that historians will say President Trump's speech to Riyadh, based on his conviction and his insight about how to reframe the Middle East, completely changed the future of the Middle East and opened up pathways to peace between Israel and its neighbors, and also opened up the pathway towards Arab and Muslim nations finally being able to take a stand against extremism.
Let me switch totally to the current occupant of the White House. What is your analysis of the opening couple weeks of the Biden presidency?
Well, for one thing, it's the exact opposite of what I described in terms of that top-down process. So with President Trump, it was top-down in the best sense of the word, right? You elect a leader, Newt. You elect somebody to have a vision, to have convictions, and then to hire a staff and run a government to put those views and convictions into effect. That's how democracy works. The energetic executive. And so everything President Trump believed, everything President Trump felt in his heart was the right thing for America, which was always his North Star, was communicated to his staff. So he'd call me and he'd say, hey, you know, we need to develop a message from the Middle East. Here's my thoughts on policy. Here's my thoughts on rhetoric. Here's my thoughts on how we need to frame this thing. And it was very top down on policy, on process, on content, the whole thing. You can tell very clearly the Biden administration, having been in the White House, having been on campaigns, having worked in Congress, having worked for many principals, which you can tell is it's bottom up, but in the worst possible meaning of that phrase, because bottom up in the White House means that unelected people are running the country. So you can tell with his speeches that President Biden has no idea the meaning of what he's saying. I'm not saying that as a pejorative note. When he's talking about reintroducing critical race theory and fighting institutional racism, Joe Biden has no clue what he's talking about. He issued an executive order, right, reimposing critical race theory training in the federal government. if Joe Biden sat down at the table without any notes, without any coaching, without anything, and was asked, the floor is yours for 5 minutes. Tell us what critical race theory is and why you've just ordered it imposed on the whole country. You and I both know he couldn't answer that question. Then why did he give a speech about it, and why did he sign that executive order? Because junior staffers in his White House are pushing their pet projects through the government. That is a very scary thing, right? The wheels are off. What you're seeing with a slew of executive orders, you have people, maybe, you know, they majored in political science at Brown University, and they graduated 3 years ago, and they read Slate and Nation magazine every single day, and now they're writing executive orders, and they're shoving them through. People who have no sense of how these policies impact real lives and real people, right? And you're seeing that, you know, very calamitously on the border. This is what happens when you have people who have no law enforcement knowledge, no law enforcement experience, no contact with the real world, playing make-believe government, except it's real life. And it's very clear to me that Joe Biden's discovering what he's saying as he's saying it, that he's not actively involved in creating the content of his speeches, and especially in the policies therein. And that's a very scary thing.
So how long do you think they can sustain all this?
It's a really great question. So he's done, you know, roughly speaking, 50 executive orders and actions, which even liberal journalists have acknowledged is the most ever by a long shot in this time frame. And they're systematically orienting and reordering our society. Some of them are happening right away. Some of them are a roadmap for very extreme regulations to come down the road. So, for example, on his energy executive order, he requests a plan on how to deal with the social cost of carbon, right? The social cost of carbon. So that's laying the groundwork for a massive government intervention into every aspect of American life. Then you have things that are happening, you know, immediately, right away. Keystone Pipeline gone. Those jobs gone, right? Borders open. Those things are happening immediately. And it really is a communications challenge, Newt, is what I would submit to you, is it's a communications challenge. Because you and I are following this. Your listeners are following this. Engaged people online are following it. But if you're just an everyday citizen working a job, if you're lucky enough in the pandemic, and you're getting your news, just whatever stories are pushed on Facebook or Twitter, or whatever you're going to see on the broadcast news, or flipping through the channels 15 minutes on CNN, or just reading a wire story that gets in your local paper, you'd have no idea any of this is going on. Republicans need to mount an extremely diligent, aggressive communications operation to educate the American public about each and every action and what it means and how it impacts their life. If they do that, this project will be unsustainable because gravity always catches up with you. We're not even a center-left country, let alone a radical-left country. You cannot govern this way for a long period of time if people are actually informed about what you're doing. So I think that's the answer to your question.
But in that context, how big a challenge is the absolute stonewall of the media to carrying the stories?
Huge challenge. Obama didn't have a protective shield even approaching that. And by the way, you know, if you compare Obama and Biden, again, whatever you may say about Obama, there's no question whatsoever that he had a very clear vision that he was very committed to, that he believed in very deeply, and that he spent a lot of time and energy trying to figure out how to articulate. You know, in a sense, you'd rather have that than a case where unseen, unheard of staffers are rewriting the whole rules of American society with absolutely no public accountability of any kind whatsoever. But to your question, Obama never had that kind of protective shield, where major outlets would make entire storylines just disappear, and where social media companies, which now far more than then people rely upon for their news, can create a completely alternate constructed reality if they desire. And that does present a fairly existential challenge for conservatives in terms of overcoming that. And I think that one of the answers there is to really make sure that we're all pushing as conservatives the same message at the same time, because it's easy to make a single person disappear. It's easy to make two or three voices go silent. You know, if one person steps out from the pack and says, hey, this thing is going on, I don't like it, it's easy to erase that person's presence online. But if everybody, all the House Republicans, all the Senate Republicans, all the major voices in the conservative movement, are all speaking the same truth at the same time, even about the most controversial issues. Take, for example, this issue about Biden trying to have men compete in women's athletics. You know, if a single individual tweets a wrong thought on that issue, the tweet will be erased from the face of the earth. But you can't make everybody's thought disappear. Definitely a strength in number concept here.
I've noticed that the American left is now getting so radical that even the French are beginning to worry about it. What is your take on the whole French reaction against the American left?
I think it's a really telling inflection point. And so the first time that I noticed this phenomenon about us as a country sending destructive political values to other countries was when they started the statue destruction effort in the United Kingdom, right? So this was something that came up in the United States, a radical left progressive effort to purge and rewrite history, which, as I mentioned earlier, is something that's been going on for a long time, but it just gained steam and force, and it's mainstreamed within the left recently. And then when I saw them trying to take down busts of Churchill in the United Kingdom, I said to myself, we've really gone full circle here. The United States is the summit of Western civilization. Western civilization is evolved for years and centuries, tracing back to the earliest civilizations, ancient Greece. And we took all the best features, we learned from all the mistakes, and we created this extraordinary republic. And now there's a movement of self-loathing, deep-seated self-loathing on the left. Some of it's sincere, some of it's a craven vehicle for power. Now we're exporting that self-loathing to other countries in Western civilization and threatening, in turn, to fracture those societies. Before the pandemic, one of the enjoyable things about my job was the chance to interact and have meetings with ambassadors of different countries and talk about world affairs. And so I had a chance to have dinner a few times with the French ambassador, who in their system is a career civil servant rather than a political appointee. And we talked a lot about the political issues of the day. But one thing, even though he was a liberal, he was very emphatic on, was the importance of French identity. They made it very clear in saying that to him, French identity was explicitly non-racial, was not a racial identity. Never, ever did that enter his mind, that it was a cultural identity, and that this is why they didn't use hyphenated terms in France. In other words, the way that, you know, in America we say Italian-American or Latin-American or Polish-American, he said that in France we don't do that. In France, we're just French. And the idea of French citizenship, equality, fraternity, brotherhood is fundamental to who we are. And so I think what you're seeing right now in France is dismay that identity politics are taking root in now the global left, which, you know, again, it's long been a vehicle for disunity in our country, but now it's taken root in the global left and is being used to try to fracture and splinter other societies. And that's not to say, I want to be very clear, France has been making a lot of very terrible political decisions for a very long time. And there's plenty of blame here to go around. But the point that I'm making is that the progressive left in America has developed an ideology that is inherently destructive to any society where it takes root.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that it is almost nihilistic, and that in the end, if you follow them to their logical conclusion, everything falls apart.
It's a philosophy that's at war with nature itself, right? We see that increasingly. And, you know, our founding fathers were big believers in the idea that a good understanding of human nature had to inform the creation of our government. And I don't want to get off into this too much, but just to illustrate the point that, you know, checks and balances on power, because we understand the human nature for avarice and greed, understanding the need to have a Senate to make sure that the instant passions of the moment in the House could be cooled, to have an electoral college, to make sure that our states as sovereign entities could have a say in our electoral process, and on and on and on, because they understood that people need to feel a sense of ownership and belonging over the place and where they lived. All of those things were informed by an understanding of human nature. The left that war with human nature.
Isn't that why the 1776 commission was really an important idea?
By the way, to my point about bottom up, so Biden canceled the 1776 commission in a speech explaining that it was all manner of ahistorical and threatening and so forth. Does anybody really believe that Joe Biden knows anything about what was in the 1776 commission? That Joe Biden woke up in the morning and said, boy, I really want to cancel the 1776 commission for the following reasons? No, somebody on his staff who's a big believer in the 1619 project said, I'm going to cancel the 1776 commission and I'm going to write an executive order and nobody's going to stop me. But yeah, the 1776 commission is all about telling the true story of American history as an exceptional nation. I would argue, Newt, it is foundational to destroy Americans' faith in their own country and its history. It's a prerequisite for a radical transformation. Because if you believe that our nation has a noble history, yes, obviously, there are things that were done in the past that were wrong. But compared to other nations, the United States is the most virtuous country that has ever existed. But if you believe that America is an iniquitous nation, an unworthy nation, a systemically racist nation, then the current system isn't worth preserving. And that's why it's so foundational to the left to destroy Americans' faith in themselves, their past, and their present, because that is the precondition for building their new future. But when I say it's at war with human nature, what I mean by that is that teaching people to hate themselves, teaching people to hate their country, teaching people to hate their past is unnatural. It is unnatural. Teaching children to hate their surroundings is unnatural. Societies flourish and societies grow when they have a healthy patriotic spirit. It's the glue that holds us together, and it's the thing that inspires us to be better and greater tomorrow. Without that, society begins to unravel.
So let me ask you to go from the gigantic historic struggles. What's next for you?
Well, I've got a lot of different projects that I'm working on. And it's hard to believe it's only been, you know, a few days since there was a change in administrations. I also have a young daughter at home, just about 3 months old. And so she keeps her mom and dad very busy. But I'm working on a few different projects that I hope I can be back and update everybody on soon. The shortest umbrella concept that I would provide is this. The movement that President Trump started in 2016 has so much more to build and grow and add and contribute. I want to be a part of articulating and developing these ideas and policies and philosophies. I want to be a part of protecting our country today, about pushing back against the Biden administration's lawless overreach and creating a roadmap for helping to take back the House, take back the White House, and build a country that is more unified, more safe, and more prosperous.
That's tremendous. Well, listen, I have no doubt, given the journey you've already been on, that the next chapter will be equally exciting and equally positive in its contribution. And I look forward in the future to having you come back and report to us as your personal odyssey continues.
That's very kind, and I can't wait to do that. And I want to thank you again for your leadership, your inspiration, and I hope that, again, your audience knows that behind the scenes, Newt spends an extraordinary amount of time mentoring to younger conservatives who are just getting started out on their careers, asking for no credit himself, just to help the cause, just to help the movement. And it's unseen, but he does it every single day.
You're very kind. And frankly, working with people like you is such a joy that it would be hard not to do it. So I'm delighted. And I wish you and your family a great future. And I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. Look forward to talking to you.
Thank you to my guest, Stephen Miller. You can read more about his time in the White House on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.